Hi, thanks for joining us this morning. I'm Chrissy Mernon, and my guests are Clarissa Thompson. She is with the Texas Organ Sharing Alliance, and she brought along with her a miracle of modern medicine, Andy Post. He is a heart transplant recipient. He received his new heart in 2014, and we're going to talk about what Andy went through and how Andy's here today because somebody made a very important decision to be a lifesaver. And so we'll talk about that. And so, Clarissa, welcome. I know February is a big month for hearts.
And for sure. It's a very big month for heart. We want to have everyone check if they have a heart, not just inside, but a heart on their license that we call the hero's heart, because we're going to be celebrating National Donor Day, you know, celebrating the gift of organ, eye, and tissue donation.
And that is coming up on?
It's coming up on February 14th. So while you're looking, buying hearts for your Valentine, you know, consider how else can you share the love? And that's considering to be an organ, eye, and tissue donor. And we really had a remarkable year this past year. In fact, this last year, 170 people, you know, said yes to the gift of donation, and 568 lives were saved because of that.
So there were 568 organ transplants based on, in here in South Texas?
It's in Central and South Texas. So TOSA, Texas Organ Sharing Alliance, we cover from Waco down to the Valley and out to Laredo, and we help families who want to give that gift of donation or those who have already registered themselves to give that gift of life. And so, yeah, 170 people have made that decision. 44% of those 170 actually made it on their license and registered themselves onto the Donate Life Texas registry. So they checked if they had that heart. If they didn't, they took care of that so their family wouldn't have to worry about that. And because of that, 568 lives in our area were saved.
That's 568 people who were waiting for a transplant, got their transplant last year because of the decision that affected 170 people. So while that's great, and that's a, you said a 22% increase from 2016, that doesn't even put a dent in the huge need, because what are the numbers as far as people who are waiting right now?
There is a very huge need. Right now, 11,000 Texans are waiting for a life-saving gift. That's men, women, and even children. You know, yesterday we were at an event out for children, transplants for children, and it was just amazing to see that there's still a need. So Bexar County, we're right above the cusp at 51%. The state is registered at about 49%. And I know I'm sharing all these numbers, but really it's the faces behind those numbers. It's those individuals that are waiting. When you see a kid that has to go to dialysis several hours a day, you know, because of that need for a kidney, which is the organ most in need, you wonder, what can I do? And it's something very simple that we can do. And that is taking a look at our license and saying, no, I have that hero's heart. How can I give back? And that's considering being an organ, eye, and tissue donor. And it's super easy to do nowadays.
Mm-hmm. So what do you attribute the big increase in 2017 to?
You know, I have to say it's a combination of things. I think it's really having that conversation more, you know, opportunities like this where we get out. In fact, that's what we're looking for really big this year, is how can we collaborate with our partners out there in the community? So if you have a church, if you're part of a big business, if you're part of a school, you know, is there an opportunity that we can come out and not just come out and share the facts about donation, but share the stories? In a little bit, you're going to hear Andy's story, but it's those people who have been waiting, who are now saved because of that gift, or those families that gave. And so I attribute it just to having the conversation more. Again, when you register, you lift that burden off your family of having to make that decision. And I think that's a key thing. I think more and more people are getting comfortable talking about donation. It's not about death, but it's about life and it's about legacy. So I think by being more comfortable, they're saying, okay, what can I do to take care of it? Let me take care of it, be done with it, and not have to worry about that. And that's considering signing up.
So tell me about the gentleman you brought with you this morning, Andy Post.
Oh my gosh, Andy is a great guy. We have a Friends for Life volunteer group. In fact, if you're out there, if you're a donor family recipient or just have a heart for donation, you know, we would love for you to join our Friends for Life group. And Andy's been with us for a few years, and I love his hashtag, and he'll talk a little bit more about it, but it's called Living for Two. And that's really what's amazing about our volunteers. They not just live for themselves, but they're like, how can I get this word out and give hope to those 11,000 Texans waiting? And that's what Andy does every day. Just a remarkable man in his field, in his faith, and also in his mission to save lives.
And Andy was quite a young man when a problem developed. Andy, tell us your story.
Yes, good morning. Well, thank you for having me. So back in 1999, I was living a normal life. I was very active, playing church softball and basketball, and you know, being a normal band director was my profession. Loved kids and loved working hard. And in 1999, I was diagnosed with viral cardiomyopathy.
Where did that come from? I mean, you know, because I'm sure you were stunned because you were thinking you were the picture of health.
Exactly. So basically, I'd been on a band trip. We had taken the kids from San Antonio up to Dallas and had gone to Six Flags. And, I, being the guy that I like to be active, I rode all the rides with all the kids and everything and wasn't feeling too good. And the chaperones and the kids are saying, you don't look too good, Mr. Post. And I said, yeah, I don't feel so good. They said I had a lack of color and I was coughing a lot. Classic symptoms of heart failure. We didn't know this at the time.
But you're only 20-something years old. Who would expect that?
Exactly. And that's one of the problems with heart disease is it can sneak up on you quickly and you can have symptoms, shortness of breath, fatigue, coughing, and you think, oh, I've just got allergies or I've got something. And being humans, we want to write it off going, oh, it's no big deal. So I come back to work after that trip and I walk up a very short flight of stairs and sit down in my band hall office and I feel like I'd run a marathon. And so then I went and saw the nurse and my blood pressure was through the roof and my pulse at rest was 180 and that should be, between 60 and 70. And so she said, I don't want to alarm you, but you need to go see the doctor right now.
Right now.
Right now.
Like go like leave school
leave
right
school
now.
Leave school and go.
And right. So I'm sure that scared you.
It was very scary. Yeah.
And exactly. What'd you do?
Went straight to the doctor. I followed the nurse's instructions. And before I knew it, I was hooked up to an EKG machine, which I had never had, all the electrodes all over me. And immediately after seeing my doctor, he sent me to a cardiologist, a specialist that day. This is all happening all the same day.
You went
day.
To school that morning and then?
Exactly. Yes. I went to school that morning thinking I'd have a normal day. And here I am lying on tables and having tests done.
So what did the cardiologist tell you?
Well, the cardiologist, after a series of tests, at first questioned, he said, well, we think you may have had a heart attack, which they ruled out the next morning after another test. But they did say that your heart has been damaged and it's been compromised. And we think you've had a virus attack your heart.
And you're trying to think, where did it come from?
Right. And so the only thing we could think is I had a root canal procedure done maybe a month or so before. Can't really remember back if I had flu-type symptoms or anything. But basically, a virus can be in your body and try to attack vital organs. And normally, your body will just rid that. Mm-hmm. And mine didn't. Mm-hmm. So here I am as a statistic at that time.
And so what did they tell you as far as what's going through your mind?
Panic. Unknown, just what's going on, why, a lot of questions, what's next, what's going to happen. And so the doctors decided we're going to treat this with a series of medicines, just oral medication and rest. I had to go home and had to stay at home and not do much and not be active, which ripped me because I love teaching and I love kids and I love music. And that was really hard to hear.
So you're going to go home and do nothing, rest.
Exactly.
And you
right.
Were so active with the band.
Right.
And playing, you played on the side as well.
Right. Right. I played trombone a lot in my church. We would play in church orchestra and also just teaching lessons to students. And then also here and there, there'd be a gig that would come up. I'd play with some of the San Antonio Symphony low brass here and there. And so, mm-hmm. To have all that stripped from you. And when I'm 27 years old at the time, that was incredibly hard to hear.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. So you're resting because you are doing everything the doctors tell
right.
you.
I was a good patient.
Yes. And you're thinking, I'm going to get better or I'm just going
right.
to manage this?
Oh, I thought I was going to get better. I was convinced this will not beat me. I've always had a positive outlook on life, but this really had me dig deeper in my faith as well. I was really, God, what's going on here? I'm going to trust in you. There's something meant for this. I don't know why, but I'm going to believe that this is for a reason. And we're going to get through this together.
You're going to come through it.
Exactly.
So what happened next?
Well, so I'm on medicine for a series of years. And then my ejection fraction, which the medical world will call your EF, is where the percent of blood is pumped out of your heart, was very low. It was not coming up. It should be a normal one, should be 60, 70%. And mine was down at 10%. And after all the medicines, they brought it up to around 25%. And the doctors were not convinced that was good enough. So then they decided to implant a defibrillator inside me, in my chest. And so that was the next step, was to have meds, but also let's put a defibrillator in you. Serves as like an airbag in case I would go into cardiac arrest this would serve a shock to the heart to make sure it would get the heart back pumping.
Did it ever go off while?
It never went off, but it was there in case it needed to.
Yeah, that's right. You don't want it to go off, but you want to have it in case you do need it. Right. So that was the next step.
Was the next step. Well, and actually, when I was getting tests done for that, that's when I came up with the idea. As I'm laying, going through all these tests, a CT scan, I thought, you know, we need to start living life and not letting life scare us. And I went home that day and I told my wife, I said, we need to start living life. We had two kids at the time when this series of tests went down, and they were 5 and 2. And I said, call me crazy, but I would love for us to get in the car and drive all over America. And I love baseball. We need to go see Major League Baseball stadiums and go visit different cities. And what do you think? There's 30 of them. And she goes, I'm in. Let's do it.
So you got in the car.
We got in the car. And over a series of summers, you know, being teachers, we had the summers off. And so that made it flexible with our schedule. Mm-hmm. And we would spend, you know, 2 weeks in the car. And we had never driven really anywhere except a few hours to go to Houston or Dallas. But we drove, I mean, we're driving all over the country. We're going out to California, Florida, New York. Mm-hmm. And so we did this for several years. And then we got to another stumbling block where the doctors were going to upgrade my defibrillator to now they had a new device that served as a pacemaker and a defibrillator, which they didn't have back when I was first needing some extra help.
So you go for that where they implant the new and improved model?
Right, exactly. So I had that. And so that put us on the sideline for, you know, a little while because you have to recover. In the entire time this is going on, I'm still not feeling good. Mm-hmm. My heart is dilating ever so slightly over the years, and it's getting bigger. And a lot of imagery I like to use is that if you put your hand, you make a fist and you put it over your chest where your heart is, that's the size of a normal heart. Mm-hmm. Well, over the course of time, mine got to be not just two fist sizes, but almost three fist sizes, 2.5.
So it just enlarged?
It enlarged, it dilated, and that is not good on your body. It makes everything, all your organs work in harmony with each other. Mm-hmm. But that just puts a lot of strain on your body.
So you were feeling like a really old, tired
I was feeling
person?
Really old, really tired, really fatigued, shortness of breath. Everything was exhausting just to even have a conversation. And so in the meantime, I'm getting up and being a dad and a husband and going to work and being a band director because I loved it.
But that sounds like you just struggled. I mean,
I struggled a lot.
Really, really hard. And you have such a cheery disposition. And so I guess that masks some of the agony that you were in.
I think so. You know, my big thing is all the kids I've taught over the years is I would show up and ask the kids to give me their best effort and to have fun. And so I felt called to teach, and I felt like this is my mission field. I'm supposed to come and not tell kids how sick I am, how I don't feel well, but I'm here to give my best effort and not just to teach you music, but life skills in the process.
Gosh, what an inspiration. So you're really, I mean, struggling along.
Right.
And when did the first mention of transplant come up?
Well, I'll never forget. It was one of my last visits with my cardiologist, and this would have been in the fall of 2011. And my cardiologist said, "You might be bummed to hear this, but I think it's time to look at. You might need a heart transplant."
And, oh my gosh!
Right, exactly. And when those words came out of his mouth, I don't think I heard anything else the rest of the appointment. So it was a good thing I had my wife with me to fill me in.
Mm-hmm. So what did she say? He said.
She said, yes, we need to go see a transplant specialist here in San Antonio, and that's the next step. They're going to put you through some more tests, and this is real now. We're not looking at just trying to fend this off with medicines and pacemakers, but it's time to look at possibly getting you put on a transplant list.
If you want to live, you have to have a heart transplant.
Right.
I can't even imagine what that does to your family, what that does to you.
It was really hard to hear. We were very scared. But at the same time, again, I kept going back to, I know things happen for a reason. I firmly believe that. And I thought, you know what? Okay, God, I'm in this. I'm going to trust that there's a reason for all this. I don't know what it is at this time. But we're going in. This is real now. I didn't want to believe it for years, but and then when my doctor told me this, I really didn't want to believe it. But my wife was like, this is happening and we've got to face this and we're all in. We're with you. you know, you got friends and family supporting you here, but we're in this now.
Our guest this morning, Andy Post. He is a heart transplant recipient. He received a new heart in 2014. He's going to tell us about that. Along with us this morning, Clarissa Thompson from the Texas Organ Sharing Alliance. And she's always urging you to think about becoming an organ donor, putting that heart on your driver's license, because that's as simple as it is, isn't it?
It is. It really just takes a few minutes. And if it's not time to renew your license, you can also go online at donatelifetexas.org and take care of it there. But it's stories like Andy, which really gets us out there. It wakes me up every morning to say, okay, what can I do today to make different to get the education out there? And let people just know that it's not a scary thing. I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there about, do I really want to donate? Is it a scary thing? And I think really it's not. It's a gift of life. And a lot of people think, well, maybe I'm too old to do this, or maybe I'm too sick to do this. There's not right now any kind of rollouts for that. Sign up, take care of it, and see what the difference that you can make, not just for saving someone else's life, but for your own family. We have so many families. It isn't that we just talk to families and we say, okay, thank you for your donation, we'll see you later. No, we have run walks, we do tree plantings, we do a lot of different activities to honor that loved one's gift. And so our donor families are just as important as the recipients are on the waiting list. And I think that's evident. You talked about earlier, what do we attribute that increase? So in 2016, we had 139 donors. 2017, we had 170 donors. That's a big increase. And not only, I think, was it the conversation, but I think people getting the education. And they can go to that same website, donatelifetexas.org, and learn the facts. You know, other people think, well, if I have that heart on my license, the doctors aren't going to save my life. That's not true. We have an excellent medical community here in San Antonio and in Texas in general. And, you know, when we find out that someone may potentially give that gift, it's a tough day for them. They've lost somebody. And we just try to turn that around and make something good and make someone make that difference. So, like I said, 44% of that 170 said yes. 21% were families that said, yeah, my loved one was a giving person. I want to make that difference. So that's a really big increase that we've seen a lot. But when you look at those numbers, every 10 minutes, a new name being added to the list, every day, you know, 20 people passing away because they don't get that, receive that gift, receive that call, it pushes you to work harder. Mm-hmm. And so we want people, we want those partnerships, we want that interaction, and we want to, you know, make it a fun thing. It doesn't have to be some boring, dark presentation. You know, mm-hmm. What is something fun and unique that we can do? Later this year, we're going to be in the River Parade with the Texas Cavaliers. We do, like I said, a big run walk later in the year. So there's a lot of fun things. Let's work together and get that word out.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to Andy and his story. So there you are. You've been hit with the prospect of a heart transplant.
Right.
Your family's rallying around you, and now you're waiting.
Right. So I'll never forget, my wife and I walk into the Texas Transplant Clinic, and we both just stopped as we read the title on the door, and it was incredibly real at that point. And we just stopped and paused and looked at each other before we went in and said, okay, here we go. And so we met with the team, and then they said, okay, we need to get you up on a treadmill stress test and kind of go from there. So I did that and did well, actually, surprisingly. And the doctor said, okay, things are okay right now. We're going to predict, this is in spring of 2012, we're predicting with all the data we have that it's probably going to be about 2 years. And they told us at this time, my medical team told me that timing is everything with transplants, especially with the heart. And so for the next 2 years, they were exactly right, because within those 2 years, I spiraled downhill pretty fast. Mm-hmm. Just the heart failure was really taking over my body. And I had to, in the fall of 2013, I worked 1 week of school. And then I was just so sick, I could barely stand. Mm-hmm. And just moving from room to room was such a process. I mean, it would take 15 minutes just standing, clutching the wall, trying to move from one room to get on the couch.
Wow. And people have no idea because you look, you look okay.
Right. Well, and that's one of the deceptions about heart failure, is you can look good. People think, well, they look fine. What's wrong with them? And that's a huge myth, is that people think you have to look sick to be sick, and that's not true at mm-hmm. all. And that goes for anybody waiting for a transplant, is, you know, kidney as well. Sometimes they can look incredible, but their body is shutting down on them.
Mm-hmm. And so now you're waiting and you're having these tough days.
Right.
And your doctor said 2 years and time's ticking away.
2 years. And time's ticking. And they were right. So flash forward 2 years. Now we're in the early spring of 2014. It's time for another treadmill stress test. And I get up there. And within 5 minutes, as soon as they raised the incline a little bit and the speed, I collapsed on the treadmill. And my doctor, I don't remember much, but I do remember them getting me on a gurney and him saying the words, "Andy, stay with us."
Oh, wow.
Right.
So he's thinking, oh my gosh.
This is not good. So apparently I skirted death that day.
Mm-hmm,
and this is in February of 2014.
And so where were you on a transplant list?
I wasn't on it yet.
Is the point where they said, okay, we need to put this.
And that's where they said timing is everything. So then they said, okay, it's time. It is now time. The heart is so compromised, and it's time to get you worked up for a transplant. And to get worked up for a transplant, that's a pretty invasive process. You spend 3 days in the ICU, which I did that spring of 2014, and you go through pretty much any and every test you can imagine from head to toe. Things I've never had done that all of a sudden I had done. They took so much blood. There's so many things that have to match up. And you have to be considered a good candidate for a transplant. You can't just say, okay, this person needs to be on a transplant list, so we're going to add you. There's lots of things that need to be done. You've got to be, and I say in good health, as good health as you can be, mm-hmm. considering you can't have any other things going on
like
in your
body. Like no bad habits. Like I'm sure there's things they look at.
Yeah, right. Well, there's things that they highly discourage if you've got some bad habits, which I didn't. But if you did, you know that you would need to stop those to mm-hmm. be considered because this is a gift of life and this is precious. And they just don't put anybody on a transplant list.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you've got to not earn your spot, but you've got to do everything that the doctors are telling you to do.
Show up and give it your best effort, like you say.
Exactly.
You know, as much as you can.
Right. And so I eventually get put on the transplant list in April of 2014. And they said in San Antonio, the average wait time was anywhere from 3 to 5 months. So then it becomes a waiting game. You're every single day you're waiting and you're wondering, am I going to get a call?
Because you have to answer that phone. And what did they tell you when that phone rings?
When the phone rings, which I never got the call, and we'll get to that in a moment. When the phone would ring, they would tell you, you need to be within, your travel's restricted. You need to be within a couple hours of the transplant hospital, which we have an amazing, amazing team here in San Antonio. So we're really blessed with that we already lived here, because there's people that live in remote areas of Texas that don't live this close, and they would have to relocate actually mm-hmm. To wait. And so we would just wait, and every day it was harder and harder each day that passed, because you're wondering, am I ever going to get a call? And the thing with a call with a match is for a heart transplant, you know, I'm a pretty big guy. You know, I'm 6'1", weigh 200 pounds, and the match would have to be somebody who's declared brain dead. And which is a tragic thing. It's the circle of life, but at the same time, somebody has to die in order for me to keep living. And that's incredibly hard to think about. Mm-hmm. You feel guilty. And I remember talking to my boys at dinner, and they're like, and they got it at this time. They're like, so Dad, somebody would have to die for you to keep living. And I said, yeah, that's exactly right. So it would have to match your blood type, the donor, and it would also have to match the size. So, you know, there were some petite women that were passing away, 5'2", small frames, 150 pounds or less. Those weren't matches for me.
For you.
For someone else.
Yeah.
It was their time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then?
So we went through the whole summer, and I remember struggling, and, you know, we would see the doctors every couple weeks. And I'll never forget, one of my doctors said, don't live life by the phone. You know, because we'd have our phone everywhere and had all these questions, and said, hey, you can go see your oldest son play in this baseball tournament. You can go see your youngest son play some tennis or play his cello. And they said, we'll get in touch with you. Don't be so. And that helped. That relieved us a little bit. That summer was incredibly hard, though. It was so hot. And when you're so sick and it's hard to move around, you basically can't get out of the house very much. So I was kind of confined to the house, almost on my own house arrest.
And that's tough for a people person who's you know, living life, yeah, or wants to live life.
It was really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the call that you were waiting for, because I'm sure every time the phone rang.
Right. Exactly. Right. We're like, okay, is this the call? You know, and the medical team would call me and I'd see the number. I'm like, oh my gosh, is this the call? And it was never the call. So we get to August of 2014. And I'm feeling about as awful as I've ever felt. And things are getting really bad. I would have extra fluid retained in my lungs. And I had to go into the hospital a couple times. And they had to drain 16 pounds of extra fluid. That was just excess water that my body was retaining.
Wow.
So it was really hard just to breathe and just to eat and do normal activities. I was on fluid restriction. There was a lot of things I couldn't do. And it's hard being told no.
Yeah.
So we get to August of that year, and I actually was so sick that my wife said, we called the team. She said, we've got to get you into the hospital. This is not good. So we get in there, and they admit me to ICU. Well, I was on status 1B of transplant list, and what that means is you have a PIC line, and it's into your there's an IV that's putting medicine directly into your body, and I had that for several months. Well, all of a sudden, I get to the hospital and they say, we're going to put you on status 1A, which means you are in the ICU. You're one of the highest priorities for a transplant at this time. And it's not first come, first serve for transplant, for a heart transplant. It's how sick you are. So when you're at 1A and you're in the hospital, it's dire straits. I mean, you are really, really sick. And within 3 days, a heart offer came in. Within 3 days of being in the hospital, right?
And so you said a heart offer came in. So you have the option to say no?
You have the option to say no, absolutely. The doctors, I don't remember any of this. I was so in and out. I was basically dying. I mean, we were at the 11th hour. My brother-in-law said that the bases were loaded. There were two outs and two strikes, and the heart offer came in at the right time. Bottom of the ninth, you know, we needed a home run. And a heart offer came in, and they approached my wife and they said, Julie, we've got a heart offer. And she said, yes, we're going to take it.
Right.
They were about to wheel me off to get what's called an LVAD. And that the doctors didn't think I would survive. That's such an invasive process. They said, he's not going to survive an LVAD. We need to do heart transplant surgery. So this heart came in at the perfect time.
And so here you are in bed. So you go to this operation, and then when you wake up, I mean, you know, when you come to, what are you?
Well, apparently right before they rolled me away, I don't remember saying this, but I told Julie and the doctors, I said, God's got this. Let's go. Let's roll. And we went there and then I woke up. It was several days later. Apparently I was in my kidneys were shutting down. My lungs were shutting down. But I remember waking up and thinking, I can breathe. I couldn't breathe for so long. And it was so easy to take breaths. And I was the perfect patient. They would come in and say, it's time to do breathing treatments. And I would do, all right, let's go. Let's do this, you know. And it was hard to get. The recovery was incredibly hard because going into transplant, I was so sick. My doctor said I was the sickest transplant patient they'd ever seen.
Sounds like they had pulled you back from death's door.
They did. Yeah, wow. They literally did. I was about to not make it.
You know, we don't have a whole lot of time mm-hmm. left, but your donor, I know now you're living for two. So what do you know about your donor? And then what
I
you
don't
say?
Know much. All I know, it was a 37-year-old female. And so a lot of people make fun. I have certain tendencies now. Some people say I'm more emotional. Some people, I do like chocolate now and ice cream. And I did like it before. I don't like sour candy anymore. Uh-huh. I used to like that. Now I have those tendencies. But every day I get up and my feet hit the ground and I think of my donor family. Who, you know, tragically lost their loved one. I live for two every day. This is a heart that I share. And I would love to meet, I've written a couple letters. I would love to meet my donor family someday, and I would probably just hug them and cry. But I would love for them to know that their legacy is living on in me. They saved my life. I'm still here for a reason. I still have work to do here on earth, whatever that is, but I'm here for that purpose. And I live for my donor and their family every day.
That is so, I mean, that's so beautiful. I know I'm sitting here with tears in my eyes.
And that's what, I mean, I've read Andy's letters because TOSA is the one that facilitates those meetings between donor family and recipients. And both parties, you know, have to be ready for that. And so it's so hard when you see these letters and you know both sides of the story. But it's amazing too to see how he honors and continues that legacy. And that's really what it's all about, is living life for two. And, you know, I just want to give the website again, you know, because, again, we're looking for volunteers, we're looking for opportunities, and we're looking for these stories, just like Andy's, to share, to encourage people to donate. And so TOSA1 is our website, Texas Organ Sharing Alliance's website. Is TOSA1.org. That's TOSA1.org. And even through that, you can link up to the Donate Life Texas Registry to sign up to save lives.
Well, thank you for stopping by, Andy Post and Clarissa Thompson from the Texas Organ Sharing Alliance.